This is a Connectability radio production.
The Shared Learning Forum series of workshops brought to you by Connectability.ca and DSTO.com. Understanding Capacity, Competency, and Consent with Elaine Acheson, the Ministry of Attorney General, Ontario. Part 1, Introduction.
It's my pleasure to introduce to you our speaker today, Elaine Acheson. Elaine is the Program Coordinator for the Capacity Assessment Office, the Ministry of Attorney General. She is a registered nurse with experience in psychiatric and psychogeriatric nursing. As a psychiatric advocate, she learned to work with legislation, specifically the Mental Health Act, and she developed an ongoing interest in patient rights and issues of autonomy and capacity. In 1995, Elaine was employed as a treatment decisions consultant for the Office of the Public Guardian and Trustee, making last resort treatment decisions under the Health Care Consent Act. As Senior Program Coordinator now for the Capacity Assessment Office, she provides training and consultation to capacity assessors who have qualified under the Substitute Decisions Act of 1992 to carry out legal assessments of capacity for property and personal care pursuant to that act.
There are two pieces of legislation that are really important for you to get a handle on, and I hope this session really helps you. I encourage all of you to read the legislation, the best document I've found in 7 years that explains how these two very complex pieces of legislation work together. It's the one by the Alzheimer's Society, A Guide to Consent and Capacity Law for Health Practitioners. It's an excellent resource. This legislation came into being in 92. It didn't have effect until 95, but it was driven by the Charter of Rights and Section 7 of the Charter. The notion that every person is entitled to life, liberty, and security of the person, and the right not to be deprived thereof except according to principles of fundamental justice. These pieces of legislation changed a lot of prior legislation, because once the Charter came into effect, every government had to look at every piece of legislation they had and make sure, if they did not respect those provisions in the Charter, that the legislation got changed. It was a long process. It was a lot of consultation with all the professional groups, with all the disability groups, with the three major parties in government. It went on for years. It was chaired by a man called Stephen Fram, so it's sometimes called the Fram Commission. But there were a lot of very good players on that who struggled with these issues about who gets to decide if somebody's not capable to decide, and to come up with a schema that was understandable to everyone and was the same for everyone, whether you were in a psychiatric facility, you're in the community, you're in a group home, the rules are the same for everybody. Okay, so it's important to get to know the rules, because they are your tools for solving clinical problems. Okay, if you know what the law provides for you and what the fallbacks are, you're going to find unraveling some of the difficult scenarios and dilemmas you get in that much easier to unsnag, because you'll know who is the go-to person. Okay, and that's what I hope to help you understand a little bit about today. Substitute Decisions Act is the act, and I would say, if you remember that the S as being a dollar sign, because most of the time when you're looking at the Substitute Decisions Act, you're going to be looking at managing property. So it's a good way to try and start sorting them out. Health Care Consent Act, again, if you think of hospital, Health Care Consent Act, this is when you're mainly going to be turning to this act. The Personal Health Information and Protection of Privacy Act. And the only reason I've mentioned it here is that it borrows very strongly from the Health Care Consent Act in terms of who can sign for release of medical information if the person's not capable. It's the same hierarchy of who gets to decide. Okay, so it's useful to know that, because you're going to be taking clients to doctor's offices and they're going to want to make a referral to somebody, and they're going to want the client's consent to send the information. But you need to know, if the client's not capable for that decision, who is the substitute decision maker, because that's the person who can sign the release. Okay, so it is important to get your handle on this. I want to talk mainly about two terms You hear about powers of attorney and guardians. First of all, a power of attorney is a document. It's not a person. So the document can be created by any of us when we're capable. It is a planning tool. We can all do one. We can't be compelled to do one. It's voluntary. But if we choose to do a power of attorney for property, and it's a continuing power of attorney because it has those words in it, then that allows us to decide who would look after our money if it was tonight when we leave here and we're unconscious in St. Mike's. Who is going to manage your money? Who's going to receive your income, apply for your health benefits from work, make sure that any entitlements you've got come to you, and also look after paying your bills so your mortgage doesn't go in arrears, your house doesn't get sent for power of sale. Somebody needs to have authority to do it. And it's creating that document, and the person you name in that document to take the responsibility is your attorney. It's not a lawyer, it's the person named in the document. Now the difference with guardians are appointed after you become incapable. So if you fail to plan by doing a power of attorney document, then on the property side, there needs to be an action. There needs to be an assessment by one of the people I train, the capacity assessors, to create authority either for the public guardian and trustee or for the family members to take this evidence of incapacity and go to court and ask a judge to appoint a guardian to manage your property. It's costly, it takes a lot of time, and it may be contentious if you have three brothers and sisters and they're all vying to be your guardian. It can set up family divisions. But that's the biggest difference. Guardians get appointed for incapable people. Attorneys, powers of attorney, get created by an individual when they're capable, and they get to choose. So we'll talk about some of those limits. So, again, there's similarities between these two acts because of the need for them to be in compliance with charter. So they had to have a lot of the same things. So they say in it, what is capacity? Capacity is defined in Ontario as the ability to understand the facts relevant to a decision and the ability to appreciate the consequences of decisions you make or fail to make. That legal test applies throughout the legislation. It's what Ontario chose as its definition of capacity. Now, if you go to BC, you're going to face a different definition because it is a provincial decision to inform these definitions and then to develop legislation that flow from them. Again, the acts say, who has the authority in law to determine whether somebody is capable to make their own decisions or needs a substitute to be appointed? So there are very specific rules in the legislation about who gets this onerous task. Again, the powers of attorney, I've said capable people can choose to do them. And the legislation says who gets to decide in a ranked hierarchy and if there are no powers of attorney. The due process protections, that means that any time somebody is assessing you for whether or not you're capable for a decision, if they find you incapable, they have to tell you. You know, they can't just go and start getting substitute decisions behind your back. You have the right to know you've been assessed. You have the right to know the finding, and if you disagree with the finding, there's a mechanism set up within the Health Care Consent Act that allows you to make an application to something called the Consent and Capacity Board, which is a quasi-judicial body set up to review these decisions. The acts authorize one person to make a finding of capacity or not. That person could be wrong. And if you disagree with their finding, you have the right to apply to this board. It's free. It turns up within 7 days of an application, so it's fast. You have the right to seek legal counsel to go before the board, but you don't have to. And the board is strictly looking at, did the assessor, whoever the person was that made the determination of incapacity, did they find enough evidence of incapacity to rebut the assumption in law that we're all capable? We get up in the morning, we're capable. We don't have to set out to prove we're capable. The law assumes we're capable. Okay, and we're going to talk about when might you need to start questioning capacity. I've said what the legal test is. I think I've gone over these definitions. This is a two-part definition. You have to be capable on both sides of this test. You have to both understand the facts and appreciate the consequences. The onus is always on the person doing the assessment to develop the evidence to withstand an appeal to the Consent and Capacity Board. Those decisions are appealable to court, and a couple of them have actually gone to the Supreme Court. Okay, because remember, we're back at a charter right. This is big stuff. So what do I mean by assessments? The term used in the Healthcare Consent Act is for some assessments or evaluators, but it's basically the same process. It's about probing the person's ability to take in new facts, to retain them, apply them, problem solve around them, reach a reasoned decision. Not necessarily a reasonable decision, but a reasoned decision. It's about the functional capacity to take in information and have enough gray matter to process it, to have the instrumental skills, to have an ability to communicate a decision, and to demonstrate that you have thoughtfully applied a kind of risk analysis. What will happen if I do A versus what will happen if I do B? And to process that information, get to the decision about A or B. You can't sit there and waffle. So you have to be able to get to a clear, reasoned decision that you can pursue through to its goal. And you need to be able to justify why that choice is consistent with your wishes, values, and beliefs. Okay, and again, that seems a little discreet, but again, if people do really crazy things that are out of character for them, it's not that we can't do it. We can do anything crazy when we're capable. I mean, people go bungee jumping. That to me is the epitome, on a judgmental basis, of crazy. Spend $300 to climb a mountain and jump off with a rope on your ankle? A, I think it's a terrible use of money, but it's a hell of a risk of life. So to me, that's a crazy decision, yet capable people have a right to go and do it. Okay? And it's our right to take risks, to do kinds of crazy things that makes us free and democratic. So it's important rights to protect. There's a difference between a legal assessment and a clinical assessment. You all may be involved in doing clinical assessments for your health practitioners. Fixing problems, identifying them, diagnosing them, and then finding an appropriate treatment. That's clinical. A legal assessment, the only outcome ever is a decision about who gets to decide. So the outcome of a capacity assessment or an evaluation under the Healthcare Consent Act is always the person retains the right to decide, or the person loses their right to decide, and a decision maker, a substitute decision maker, is appointed to make the decision for them. So they're qualitatively very different. Okay, and that's the only possible outcome of a legal assessment. Then I said there's an assumption of capacity, but there are some red flags. You know, when there's evidence that the person may in fact have experienced an illness or is in a state that they ought not or don't appear to be processing the information, then the onus is to do a little probing. Is in fact the information going in? Is it sticking? Are they aware of it when they're trying to decide? And if they can't, you know, if the person within 3 or 4 minutes can't tell you what they've told them about, then one would make a reasonable assumption with further probing that perhaps they're not capable because one of these things have happened. You know, they're in a delirium. They've got a urinary tract infection, they've got a fever of 103, and they just have enough poisons in their blood that they're floaty. And they're not attending. They can't because they're too physically ill. Somebody who's had chemotherapy may be so preoccupied with nausea and so knocked out that they're just not functioning. Okay, so under those circumstances, it is reasonable and it's required where there's reason to believe the person may not be able to take in information, to learn the new facts, to apply the facts to their situation. There needs to be a documentation of what you saw that caused you to believe the person's incapable. and then a movement to finding who the highest ranked person with the right to make these decisions for the person. Okay, so again, psychiatric conditions, it's not an equal sign. Because I'm diagnosed as schizophrenic does not mean I'm incapable. But if I am schizophrenic and my doctor is talking about changing my medication, he better slow down and take time and make sure that I'm getting the information I need to make an informed decision. And he needs to test back my ability at that time, because we can be capable today and incapable tomorrow for the same decision. Again, some of these conditions have a lot of fluctuation associated with them. Somebody with a roaring infection after 48 hours of antibiotics may in fact become capable again. Okay, so those are some of the things you've got to be aware about in terms of capacity.